All lines are now bridged.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Information Blocking Task Force meeting. Quick roll call, and then we will get started with an output view from our two work groups, 1 and 3. Andy Truscott?
Present.
I believe Michael will be late. Stephen Lane?
Good morning.
Cheryl Turney? Denise Webb?
Present.
I believe Sasha is going to be absent. Aaron Mary. Arianne Malik may join us late. Valerie Gray.
Here.
Anil Jain.
Good morning.
Good morning. Cynthia Fisher.
Yes, present.
John Kansky. All righty. Lauren Thompson and Denny McClellan. All right, Andy, I'll turn over to you to get us started.
Thanks very much, Lauren. Hey, good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining. This is the first of the come-togethers as a full task force with the outputs from the various work groups. I'll just start walking through these together. We do actually have a revised timeline that we're working to. So, Mark, can you quickly just keep us all up to speed on that?
You mean just share my screen, or did you want me to talk about the document?
Well, you can do both.
Okay. Well, I'll click share the screen, and then, just generally speaking, Andy has taken, much of the recommendations that are cleaner from the Google Docs we've been working off and made a separate document that we're going to kind of go through this morning. Appreciate everyone joining so early, especially the folks Central and West Coast. So, I think the goal here is we're going to start with Work Group 3 and try to get through those recommendations. And it seems like those are pretty well settled, but we definitely want the entire group or whoever is able to join today to weigh in. Then hopefully we'll have some time to start jumping into where Work Group 1 is at with their work. I mean, there's still some outstanding issues. We're talking about price transparency later today, but we're not going to discuss that on this call, I don't believe, but we've made good headway in all three groups. And as far as Work Group 2 goes, we're saving that because the work group members are working through their different recommendations and putting pen to paper right now, but we'll have more in the coming meetings.
So Mark, thanks for that. That wasn't quite what I wanted.
Yeah. Okay. What do you want?
The revised timeline that we're working to.
Oh, the revised timeline. Okay.
Yes.
Let me try to pull the screen back up, though, and stop sharing, because I misunderstanding here.
Thank you for the introduction to everything else.
Well, now I'm having issues. I know, Lauren, do you have the timeline? I'm trying to figure out how to stop sharing.
It's up now.
Okay, it is. I can't find the screen. Let me try to do that. I've had some issues once I start sharing where the...
That's okay.
Can you run through the changes?
Okay.
Oh, here, I've got it up. All right, I think... bear with me, folks. Oh, shoot.
Okay. I got it, Mark, if you can't see it. So the plan is to hopefully present final or near final draft recommendations next week on the 10th. I would say as many as possible. If we're able to present those for a vote for the full committee, we'll do so. But otherwise, we will do that at our next full high-tech meeting on the 25th, which is virtual. I think we'll see how it goes with today's call with getting through kind of any outstanding issues for those recommendations that are near final. And then I think we'll just have to regroup with the co-chairs offline to see what, if any, will be ready to present for a final vote next week on the 10th.
Yep.
Thank you very much.
This is the time I've been watching you guys. Let's crack on with it, basically. Any questions from the task force membership? I will take that as tacit agreement and we'll carry on. Okay. Mark, can you now put up the document we're going to start working through?
Yeah, so I just had to exit out of Adobe, and I'm going to try to get back in now because I was having some issues. So give me 1 second, and that should be up. Right.
Yeah. Okay, so what we've done, team, is we've produced a single document that we've taken out a lot of the discussion notes and everything we've made. We've obviously retained those for posterity, but we've taken out a lot of the notes we've been working through, and we just simply have the original regulation draft. We have our proposed regulation draft, and we also have alongside that, so you can see all three together, a marked up version that has the process with all the markups in and deltas from the original text. So we can completely see the changes that we are making and see them in context. We've also preserved in that document the discussion points and any preamble recommendations that we've made as well. It's our intent that this is the content which will form the backbone of the letter of transmittal that goes to the Office of the National Coordinator, and we take it that way. So I hope that's pretty clear. And we're going to start with work group 3, which is scrolling on screen. Okie dokie. And
can you all see that, Andy?
Yep, you can. Are you viewing it in markup mode?
Oh, yeah, in markup mode.
You're not logged in appropriately, are you? So you can't see the actual comparison markup deltas.
How do I have to log in for this? My apologies. Do I need to exit out? And I just clicked on the link, and this is what it took me to.
Yeah, well, it's logged you in.
Try the top right where it says sign in.
Yeah, thank
you. Okay. appreciate that. Okay, let me take this off of the screen so that not everyone sees that.
Hey, Andy, real quick, it's Aaron Miri. I joined.
So, hi. Hey, man, how you doing?
Good.
We're just getting up with the technology.
Yep.
The whole point of this task force.
Well, we're not talking about health IT. This is just more general.
All right. Let's see if this is better. I'm signed in. It's still not showing it.
If you scroll to the bottom of the first page of Workgroup 3, you should be able to see markup in there.
All right.
Go to the first tab. Left, that's okay. It. So we're all watching you. No, you're not logged in appropriately.
I just gave my Google login.
Okay, fine.
Let me try to get... Let me get out of here and then... Or share. How about that? Well, maybe that... No, that's not right. I'm in.
Okay, you should be able to see my screen now. See my screen?
I can see it.
Can you guys see my screen now?
Yes, I can see it.
Okay, fine, great. Okay. Okay.
But you'll need to blow it up bigger. You'll need to go to like 150 or 200%.
Is that better?
That's perfect. Thank you.
Okie dokie. Okay, so this is Work Group 3. I was going to suggest that actually someone from Work Group 3 might want to take us through these and walk us through. Is that achievable?
If not, I'm happy to, but you're going to get really bored of me talking for 2 hours.
Andy, this is Denise. I'm willing to help, but I'm going to have to read through each of these.
That's fine. That's bringing everyone up to speed anyway.
I'm happy to help as well. I just don't have the computer open in front of me. So.
Okay, no worries. Well, you can do color commentary about our discussions. Yep. I'll kick off, and Denise, when I get tired, you can kick in. How about that?
Okay.
Okay, so the first regulation we looked at was purely the statement around thou shalt not do information blocking, and the work group endorses the rule with no recommendations to it. Leaving as written, a health IT developer must not take any action that constitutes information blocking as defined in 42 USC, etc. And we were quite happy with that. So I had no recommendations to make.
Right. And this is a condition of maintenance maintenance and certification. The first one of several.
Yes.
Yeah. And this task force or work group just looked at information blocking assurances and communications.
Yes.
I'm just hoping that whoever else is listening to know that we only looked at three in this task force.
And we, just to chime in, you also looked at the enforcement overall issues with that.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, so the second was 402 assurances. And Denise, you want to walk through this?
Okay, so assurances had to do with making assurances that you were not taking any action that constitutes information blocking that could inhibit the appropriate exchange, access, and use of electronic health information, and also to ensure that the health IT certified under the ONC program works as advertised and meets the requirements. I'm trying to recall here, Andy, what we changed in our proposal, though. This is where, okay, here we go. So down in number three, the health IT developer must not take any action that could interfere with the user's ability to access or use the certified capabilities for any of the purposes within the scope of that technology certification. And we are proposing to add, and the health IT developer shall provide honest communication and expert advice as required by a user. And otherwise, we left this intact. I believe this is the only change we proposed.
No, we have
on the
one
first
other
part.
Yeah.
I mean, on the first
so
part.
So,
is
the
a
red line mean that you're eliminating it? It reads.
No. The red line is additions. Okay. If it's a strike through, then it's a recommendation to eliminate. And you'll see that on other ones where we've proposed taking out some language. This is purely accretive.
Okay, yeah. Okay, it matches the recommendation. I see. Okay, thank you.
Right. So that's B3 is where we made it. I mean, A3 where we made a change. And then on maintenance of certification, 1I and 2 are the same, and we're proposing to add Roman numeral 3 here. If for a shorter period of time, a period of 3 years from the date of withdrawal by the health IT developer of a certified health IT product from certification. So this has to do with the documentation as far as showing that you have compliance.
Yeah, it's about maintaining.
Right. This is about retaining. This is about retaining the records. So the ONC's proposed rule, if you'll scroll back up, so I can, was 10 years from the time you're certified, or for a shorter period of time of 3 years from the effective date that that a health IT developer removes. Excuse me, that certification criteria is removed from the Code of Federal Regulations.
Yeah, basically, we just said you have to have it for 3 years at least. That, should be nothing contentious there. That just seemed to be a slight loophole that was there. This is there in Section 2, Denise, was when we were looking at the timeline.
Oh, right. And this concerns when they must comply with the requirements.
Yeah.
As far as providing the customers with the certified health IT, and it was 24 months of this final rule's effective date, no change there. And we struck within, and whichever is longer for the second part, or 12 months of certification of a health IT developer that never previously certified. And then we added number 3, that ONC will preserve on the chapel or in another format a list of the start and end dates of each previously certified health IT product. We want that to be retained in perpetuity on the site.
So,
any discussion on these proposed changes?
Can I ask? So I like to watermark proposed rules against a real world scenario for a second here, and just make sure it stands muster. And so let me give you a story. I'll redact names, but let's just see if our proposals pass muster. So in terms of vendors' information blocking behavior. Okay. So large, ginormous, certified health IT EHR vendor. They're not one that sits on the high tack. Refuses to allow for hospital provider to have a test environment to build against with APIs, forces any downstream vendors trying to connect to them and exchange data to go and either partner with them to a development program so they can take a portion of profits and or charge for the interfaces. And for any hospital tries to build against the development partner thing, they want a portion of any proceeds or additional dollars to compensate information sharing. So when I look at that situation, which is obviously, it completely dissatisfies everybody, including any startup from wanting to exchange data and try to do things better with the EHR data, which is the whole point of it, because they want more money or they want to forbid this practice. Does our proposed rules help stifle that kind of behavior to allow more freely exchange of information?
Well, would this be the right regulation to address that within?
This is conditions of certification and maintenance. So
right.
What conditions they have to meet for under the certification program and what they must maintain under the certification program. This
exactly.
particular part of the regulation does not address what I think you're describing is information blocking and where that would fall. I mean, they're violating a condition of certification and maintenance.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I was going for.
Right.
I think you're violating multiple things, including the certification of
right.
the testing
so,
and making sure they won't do that. Yeah, go ahead.
Right. So then in the scenario that, the way I read it, the scenario you described, they would be actually not meeting the condition of certification and maintenance for the assurances piece of this, as well as for the information blocking, and then the enforcement actions would then come into play.
Yep.
So I don't
okay.
think there's anything we're proposing or need to propose in these conditions that would preclude that all happening. These conditions would create those protections, I believe.
Yep. No, I agree.
I don't know.
That's why I wanted to run it against a real world, an actual real world scenario that's less than one day old, me yelling at people. So good. I'm good.
Oh boy.
But I do want you to hold on to that anger and concern, because I think there is something we'll discuss in work group one with definitions where I think that might come more into play again. So hold on to that.
Roger that.
Hi, this is Lauren Wu from ONC.
Hello, Lauren.
Hi there. So I think I recall the initial discussion around the addition of this recommended language for number three, and maybe someone could add some commentary here, and of course you are all welcome to provide whatever recommendations you feel is appropriate, but as I read it right now, I believe the chapel already does this.
Are they required to do it? Number three here on the screen, Andy.
Okay.
Yeah. Are they? Yes. We do, because that's the way that the certification ID is created when a provider or other end user goes in to create the unique ID for purposes such as attesting to CMS payment programs. There's a necessary tie-in to, the dates when that product was certified.
Okay, so Lauren, this was a question that the work group asked ONC, and the feedback we got was that was not a public list that was available in perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
Are you telling us that it is?
I can double check on this, but your question or the recommendation here is that you, if I understand it, you would like the start and end dates to be publicly available for every single listing, whether or not it currently is certified or not.
Yes.
Correct?
That was the intent of the work group.
Sure.
We're now talking about this with full task force. I think I'll just put words in task force mouth, but I don't think anyone would argue with that one. So if that's the case, it is what you do right now, then great.
Okay. I feel 85% certain on that, but I will just go triple check and I can get back.
That's a diminishing certainty. Okay, cool. Let's move on to the next one.
Andy, before we move on, this is Denise. I just have one question. So if ONC is already doing that, is there something that requires them to already do that? Because they could decide, well, we're going to implement some other system to track. I just want to make sure that, is that just a practice or are they required to do that? So if Lauren can get back to us on that.
Okay.
Too. Thanks.
Got it. Will do, Denise.
There we go. Okie dokie. Next one. So we were asked for additional information on participation in the TEF. And I know across the task force, we've discussed this in the different work groups. We've said, look, we're going to revisit this when things are published out and park that until then. And I know we've got another similar comment coming from elsewhere as well. Okay, no comments. We must move to communications. Denise, I'll hand it over to you for the meaty ones.
Okay, so this is I wish I had this on paper so I could read down to the whole thing to see what we're proposing here. So this is
go on.
Okay.
I'm sorry,
all right.
I forgot everyone's looking at my screen. I'm sorry, guys.
I am looking at your screen, but it's hard to launch a discussion until I see the whole context of what we changed. And had I known I was going to be speaking on this, I would have printed these off.
Okay.
Of course, I didn't have your document. Just
okay.
If you can scroll all the way down to where we made our change.
There you go.
Okay.
The first one.
So this portion discusses the communication about the health IT developers' products and what's protected and what's not, and those protected communications that are to be permitted If the health IT developer blocks these in any way, that's going to be considered information blocking under the conditions of the certification of and maintenance requirements. So we're proposing
This is protecting people who blow the whistle.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we added that to E. Any person who makes communication covered by 2I to an appropriate entity must not be subject to retaliatory action.
And it kind of goes without saying that this includes employees of the health IT developer.
Actually, I believe that we are adding some text in another part here of relating to self-developers, in that they are not permitted to restrict their users of their within their company. So if a health system develops their own certified IT, then the users, because there is a exception where health IT developers can put a gag on their own employees, except in the case of self-developers, the users of their product would not be able to do that. And I don't remember which section
it's
the regulation that was in.
We'll
So we did address that. Yep. All right. I mean, this is straightforward.
This is straightforward and basically saying that there's these five reasons that you have to do, and any person who alerts if you're not doing that, you can't retaliate against them. And we know full well, you know, that obviously there was whistleblowing legislation in place. However, having asked the question back to ONC, that's primarily focused at federal employees, etc. So we wanted to make a more general statement that you can't take retaliatory action against someone who blows a whistle when you're failing.
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Let's see. Where's our next change, Andy?
Okay. There we go. So we're getting to fair use.
Right. And this is where it would be good to have Sasha on, but she's not. But I know Aaron's on. So let's see. I'm not sure why fair use is in red there because it's the same. All right, so 1 and 2, we added the words fair use, communication of screenshots of the developer's health IT, and subject to the limited restrictions, which are in paragraph A2IID, which I don't know what that paragraph says. I apologize. And then we're adding, and with the understanding that any actor disclosing the screenshots are responsible for ensuring that each use is being put to fair use.
The basic point on this was, go on, Denise.
I was just going to say, there was a concern about, by some of the members on the work group, that once screenshots are disclosed, for fair use, there was some concerns, I believe, about redisclosure, if I'm recalling our conversation on this. And the original person who, actor who has disclosed the screenshots need to be responsible for what happens to those screenshots.
That's right.
Yeah.
And let me speak to the example that I gave and ask how to give coloring here. So the example was, in a prior life, I was trying to work with another hospital to exchange information. We were trying to figure out how to share specialists and whatnot. It was across country borders. And in order to do that, again, this was all for treatment purposes. It was like, okay, well, let's look at the EMR and see if we can gather the right data on your population so that we could be able to, you know, do telemedicine, teleconsult, et cetera, et cetera. And I was told by the vendor that I was using that I was not permitted to share any screenshots because of fear of IP leakage and whatnot. And in working it through, Sasha brought up a good point about how do you control and keep, you know, people from stealing your UX design and layout and whatnot, because that could be IP and proprietary nature of how things are laid out, which is a fair comment. But I said, listen, in this case, it was hospital. I'm not talking to a developer. We're trying to help, you know, take care of patients. And to that end, it should be my responsibility to make sure that, you know, no one's doing anything nefarious with it. Again, we get to assume innocent intent and fair intent. And that's how this came up to be.
Right. I remember that, Aaron. That was a really good example. And so we just definitely didn't want to preclude that kind of activity from being permissible for, you know, sharing workflows or trying to work out a situation with a particular patient, but then to alleviate some of the concerns about that sharing to make it clear that there is responsibility on both parties' part. So like the two health systems that are sharing the screens to make sure that there's fair use, that fair use is applied throughout.
Yeah. And so if you look at the original drafting, okay, over here on the left-hand side, this entire clause is around enabling developers to protect their intellectual property. In clause one in the original drafting, it does utilize fair use of a copyright work. So with our proposed drafting, we just added fair use to screenshot usage as well. And there is actually an additional section we're about to get to that discusses screenshots ad nauseum. Mark, you're about to jump in.
Yeah, I just wanted to note that we do discuss fair use in the context of screenshots in the preamble. I understand you all might be making the recommendation because you want the reg text to be clear, but I'll just read out the sentence we have in preamble just for everyone's clarification. We say, we consider that the reproduction of screenshots in connection with the making of a communication protected by this condition of certification would ordinarily represent a fair use of any copyright subsisting in the screen display, and developers should not impose prohibitions or restrictions that would limit that fair use. So I just want to make the point that we do talk about it in preamble.
You do.
I think we were concerned that, and we wanted it clear that the health IT developer does not prohibit the fair use communication.
I get that. I think it might be helpful. I understand, you know, this is a proposed recommendation for reg text. It might be helpful, Andy, when you're putting together the final transmittal recommendations, to kind of explain where you're differentiating, you know, kind of give more background on what the recommendation is, because I guess what we're saying is,
you mean,
you know, what would. Yep, exactly. Yep. Just as I haven't. That's fresh content. I haven't read everything yet, but just wanted to make, you know, just so we can understand where you think that line is drawn with regard to screenshots. Yep. And fair use.
Yeah, we have some fairly exhaustive conversation there, and we tried to capture it all. And yeah, I appreciate this is new material for everybody. It's meeting one of the full task force. That's okay, but not everyone's completely
right,
based on it.
Right, and you know, and that's why, as we're going through this, it's hard to just look at the regulatory text and not be able to see the contextual notes as well. So, you know, that's why I'm struggling a little bit with explaining some of this.
That's okay. Okay, so
all right.
The next section we have, which is more exhaustive around screenshots in general, we've left much of that intact until we get to this third section. And the premise being here, you don't infringe any third-party intellectual property.
Right.
Provided that, and then we cut to what the developer has done. And we focus in on this point around the potential reusers of that communicators of that IP. Denise.
So on this one, Andy, I can give some context for the whole task force. So if you think about a certified health IT product, that there's thousands of different screens in the user interface. And what was being proposed in the rule is that each aspect of that screen display, you know, there must be written notice about each aspect of every screen display that contains third-party content. And we collectively thought that that was extremely complex and onerous when you think about thousands and thousands of screens that could have different third-party content. And so we thought it would be more feasible and appropriate to suggest a change in the regulation to instead require that a notice of a list of the types of content, who the third parties are, and what kind of content would appear in the screens instead of an enumeration by each screen. So that's what this change is proposing here. Excuse me.
Is that clear to everybody? Right, that's a yes, Denise?
Yes, and obviously we know that this is going to require the person who's releasing those screens to, just like there would be PHI in the screen, I mean, they have to be sensitive to that already under HIPAA regulations. So they're just going to have to be cognizant of what other types of content might be in those screens.
Yep.
Okay.
And then move on to unprotected communications. You'll like this one.
Right. So our work group had quite a bit of discussion about communications that should not receive protection and are actually proposing here as a recommendation to ONC that they add in the regulatory text some language around unprotected communications. So we're actually, this is an entire addition of a new category, specific communications that are not extended the protection or restrictions in the section where those communications are considered unprotected in that they are either protected by other legislation or regulation or are false or unlawful. Andy, weren't we also going to suggest too here that we put that ONC add some examples in the preamble?
There we go. We somehow managed to steal about 7 hours of conversation to 30 words. So, this is the preamble recommendation that goes alongside that.
Right. Thank you for pulling that up.
That's okay.
So things like communications that are protected by attorney-client privilege is an example. We didn't think it, we had quite a bit of discussion about where this belonged, and we, you know, because originally I think there was a proposal to have it in the regulatory text, but that is usually not what's done in regulation. I have all these examples.
Yep. That probably makes it clearer for the task force as well about where I think it wants to. So where there is existing legislation, which would have impact, we're not trying to impinge there, but where something is clearly unlawful or false. So we think we've wrapped up pretty much every example in there. Mark, have you got any comments on this? Because I know you were pretty much in the weeds in this conversation.
No, I mean, I think what Denise said about, you know, generally regulatory text should not include, you know, the types of things like examples. So I think that's right to put it in your recommendation for preamble. You know, and you know, it's a recommendation that you all made, so I don't have any comments on that.
Okay, cool. I love this. Doing alternate ones with Denise means I get all the short ones. There was a request for comment around communication. Oh, no. There was a request for comment around communications. We read through these, we discussed them, and we actually believe that we use many of these comments to inform the recommendations we're making on the prior set of regulations has worked. So we decided that we wouldn't actually have additional commentary to make. That said, as a task force, we might. So we're going to give everybody access to these compiled drafts once we've worked out exactly how to do that, Mark. And then at that juncture, I'd like it actually, if you have suggestions and additional comments to make, we should get these in, because then we can discuss them in the upcoming task force meetings and get them churned out in our recommendations, okay?
Hey, Andy.
Okie doke. Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Andy. Andy.
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
Andy.
Yes?
Can we print this out? Just because I didn't catch that last paragraph and just wondering if this is, if there's a way that we can get access to that and print it.
Well, absolutely. You got, this is a Google Doc, just the same as everything else we've been working with. So you can have access to it. Lauren, can you quickly circulate the URL for this, please, around the entire task force?
Yep.
Hey, Andy, I think, though, since you created this Google Doc, you would need to provide access rights to everybody. So it might be easier.
It's already done. But we're,
oh, really?
Oh, yeah, it's already done.
Oh, but we didn't.
If we have access, can you send us the URL?
Yeah, we need the URL because we can't get access otherwise, Andy.
Now, that's why I asked Lauren to send the URL. Also, we will be moving this into an ONC doc. This is just one I created because they weren't able to import the markup right. So, but we are going to be addressing that. I don't know how to. So, this is, please don't make changes to this one right now. Please do just view it. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. Okay, moving on.
Andy, just a note, Estelle is in telling me about the Google Docs. I think it says anyone with the link can view, but you would need to either change it to anyone with the link can edit, or you need to invite people to edit. I think that was the issue with my version.
Okay.
It wasn't showing. No, yeah.
No worries. I've just told everyone that they can only view it anyway until we sort out the final one.
And we don't
right, but I think what – oh, okay, because what I think Mark's saying is for the task force to see the red lines, you have to send it to...
Okay.
Yeah, because if you just send it for view, I don't think the task force can see the red lines. It's just going to be a black and white.
There you go. Now you can. Text. Now you can. Mark, go back into it. Can you see the red lines?
Keep moving on, and I'll check.
Okay.
Since Mike, yeah.
Okay. Okay. So this is the review of certified health IT or health IT developers actions. So the original ONC proposal was to utilize the existing process they have for direct review, which we all know and love have been in place around maintenance and certification for a number of years now. We actually did suggest a slight addition to this in how notices are communicated, and to say that whilst the majority of communication is done by email, where there is a notice that initiates direct review, potential non-conformity, suspension, proposed termination, ban, or anything around appeals is simultaneously issued by both certified mail and email. These are notable events inside the certification process, and there has been concern raised in the past where email hasn't necessarily gone to the right place or been reviewed in a timely fashion. And we want these to be timely. We want these are important notifications and will become increasingly important as we go through the needs around information blocking. So the group felt it was important that these were provided simultaneously in certified mail as well as email. So there's a guarantee of delivery and has no guarantee of being read, but there's more of a guarantee that it's been received.
And Andy, just as far as the group's intent with this, I just want to make sure. So you're saying that you want both means of sending out notice for all of the steps that would be included for the conditions of certification, or are you saying for also the previously established direct review that's tied specifically to certified health IT? And I ask because in our proposals for conditions of certification, we're not including suspension or proposed termination. So those probably wouldn't be relevant if you're talking only about the conditions and maintenance of certification.
That's a good point. I don't believe the group has discussed that at that level of detail. Does anybody else on the work group have a view?
Well, this is Denise. I have a comment on that. If that was not done in the past, and it was only done by email to give under the program to give notification a proposed termination, I would suggest that we don't want this just to be specific to the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements.
Well, so I'll talk, and then if Lauren Wu, I know she knows this issue very well, but in Section 505, we talk about communications, and I believe the way it's written now is that for direct review for certified health IT, the default is email, but there is the possibility that that discretionary that ONC could use other means like certified mail if necessary. And I believe that's the way it's currently written.
Right, and that's what we didn't agree with. We think these are significant actions, and for ONC to use the discretion and default to email, that we know things get lost in people's junk folders, or it goes to the wrong party, and no action is taken. I mean, these are pretty serious matters to propose termination, and we just didn't.
Right.
So we are proposing that the regulatory text be changed.
I guess I'm just also. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
So that it isn't discretionary, whether it's just a default to email, or just these big ticket items.
No, and your point is well taken. I guess I'm just want to be cautious to the fact that, you know, the scope of the what this task force is looking at is really dealing with the new proposals for conditions of certification and information blocking, and including suspension and proposed termination ties back to already kind of established and litigated proposals that have been finalized. So I guess I just don't want to blur the lines there, if possible.
Well, it sounds like we're saying two things. One is we think for information blocking, it's important that these communications go through both channels. And I think we might be saying, well, okay, this might implicate how ONC is working in general if some of these communications are not going through registered mail, they're only being done through email. And are you suggesting, Mark, actually we're overstepping our boundary here? We shouldn't.
Well, no. So what I would suggest, I mean, you can make whatever recommendations you want, but I would suggest that you keep your recommended like edits to this regulatory text specific to the conditions, and you could also make a general recommendation outside of that ONC should revisit our approach to communications for certification of health IT, with health IT issues concerning the specific health IT that's addressed in direct review in the EOA final rule. Go ahead.
Well, Mark, I was going to say we generally have handled it that way. I know in our other task force, we had some general recommendations that were not specific to what our charge was. But in this case, ONC is proposing to use the same process that's already in existence for conditions and maintenance of certification requirements. So if you're going to overlap a process and apply it to these new conditions, it's not totally new. It's using an existing regulation.
Yeah, it's relevant.
With a few nuances. So I think that's why we were suggesting this. I mean, I certainly appreciate what you're saying. We can stick to conditions and maintenance of certification, and that we, as an overhead recommendation, say that these matters concerning CMC should have a certified mailing. But it's using the same process and the same portion of the regulation for CMC as it is for the overall program.
I
can weigh in here a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
So I hear Denise's point, and I think that the way that you recommended it, Mark, is actually fine. I think going back to the EOA final rule, what we say in the final rule preamble is that we do, for EOA direct review, intend to send those notices via certified mail, and we state that in the preamble. However, as you can see, the regulatory text for Section 17505 remains as it is today, where we generally say the preferred method of correspondence is email. If you scroll up a little bit, I think it says, you know, unless there is a specified reason to use certified mail. So I think maybe the point here is that, to Denise's point, since we're proposing, you know, to reuse the same sort of process and approach, that we could relook at that and see if the entire reg text needs to be updated to reflect kind of that history of our intent.
Yeah, no, and I think I think the placement of the changes, Denise, makes sense broadly. I guess maybe I got us through a rabbit hole or whatever. All I'm saying is that just in the recommendations, that you all please be clear that if you want it to apply both for direct review concerning the certified products and conditions, maybe in the text that describes your proposed recommendations, just make that clear. That's all I would say.
Well, maybe what we can do is in our preamble recommendation, just to say that we acknowledge that the final rule relating to this process before, just as Lauren described it, had it in their preamble for these big ticket items to actually use certified mail, even though the regulatory text left discretion and preference to email. I think the same applies here for CMC, but now that we're at a point where we do have the opportunity to modify the regulatory text because of the Cures Act and this proposed rule, we could make our overall recommendation to be that intent of the preamble gets incorporated into the regulatory text.
Yeah, and just thinking through, like Lauren said, the background, it might make the most sense to take a similar approach. In the end, I'm just kind of thinking through that we took in direct review, because the communications section that's up here is a very, very broad application, and we're talking about specific, really serious cases. So I think you should make the recommendation however you all think it would be best, but the approach we took in for direct review could be applicable.
Yeah, there was a fair amount of discussion on this in the work group. Much of that discussion was fueled by a very direct experience, an observation of the process, and also a belief that there is a fair chance that the direct review process will get a greater degree of exercise in enforcement of information blocking regulations. And we wanted to make sure that the communications a stifling of communication was not actually preventing the benefits and the reason why these regulations exist in the first place, and that the very real administrivia of an organization around vacations, out of offices, human resource turnover, etc., that stops that communication if you're depending upon email. So we just wanted to make it clear. We'll go back to that.
I would agree. This is Aaron. I'm going to add a little commentary. It's another. This is what I do. I add real world experience here and examples. So real world example is, even when communicating with, say, a very large vendor that is doing some unsavory practices, If it is over email, 9 times out of 10, if it's not something that they want to talk about or listen to or change a practice on, they're going to ignore you. And so to the degree of it, we were worried about enforcement action, and then just simply saying, hey, we never got it, and tough bananas, which is exactly the attitude a lot of vendors take today. And to the degree of it, certified mail is a way to, or another modality is a way to make sure that is heard loud and clear to stop it, stop misbehaving. So that's just kind of give the real world a perspective.
I think that's really helpful background, by the way.
No worries. We're a helpful group. Okay, shall we move on? The certification ban, we felt that we've made updates in our previous comments that were reflecting of this RFC, so we didn't actually need to go any more. But there was a question on the public listing of certification bans and terminations. Denise, do you want to walk us through these two recommendations we made?
So our first recommendation is around providing some indefinite communication of past records, and we do believe that that's appropriate and would like to see the start and end date. So if there's a ban on a health IT developer from the program entirely, and then the health IT developer actually takes, remediates and takes action to then be allowed to enter back into the program. There was discussion about, well, how long should they be subject to the ban, and should there be information provided to potential customers of that developer's product about whether they had a ban or not after it's lifted. And we are proposing there should be indefinite communication, at least in the form of what the product is and, who the developer is and when the ban started and when it ended. We think that's appropriate. And then we don't recommend a minimum period of time over which a ban must last. The rule asked us to consider that and make a recommendation on whether we thought there should be a minimum time period, even if the health IT vendor has had multiple offenses.
Yeah, we felt that there was a very much a contextualization which would need to be done through the enforcement process, and that there could be, whilst not legitimate, there could be understandable reasons, and we didn't want to try and second guess what they could be through regulation. Any comments?
No, this is Aaron, I agree. That was the representation of the conversation.
Cool. I was going to say, you agree, because you're in the work group. Anybody else? Because I know there are other people on the call who...
Yeah, I also agree. This is Stephen.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll move on to the next one then. So
next area concerns self-developers.
Yep.
So the rule requested, the proposed rule requested comment on whether the conditions and maintenance of certification requirements should apply to self-developers. And our work group just looked at the three conditions and maintenance of certification around information blocking, assurances, and communications. And we concluded that all of these should apply to self-developers, but then the one difference for self-developers related to the communications conditions and maintenance of certification, and those areas where the health IT developer had exemption on A here, it related to developer employees and contractors. And I mentioned this earlier in our call this morning. We are proposing that those healthcare organizations that develop their own certified systems cannot block or restrict communications on their employees using the products.
this is directly the one we referenced earlier when we were talking about whistleblowing. Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, everything would apply to a self-developer for these three conditions and maintenance of certification. And just for the task force's benefit, the CMC task force actually looked at the other conditions and maintenance of certification as it relates to self-developers. So we split that up.
Hey, Denise, what's up? Maybe the ONC guys can help us here. What's the plan for feathering these together? Is it that's going to happen when we meet as a full committee and not before?
As a full committee, my understanding, but Lauren can weigh in, or Mark.
For the all of the IB recommendations, you mean?
Well, only where we have a feathering in, like here, where there is a recommendation coming out of the Information Blocking Task Force that actually lives alongside the regulations of another task force. And, you know, whilst I know that, you know, we have enough meetings on our calendar, I'm pretty sure that I've got probably a little bit of space one day in the next 2 weeks where maybe just the co-chairs get together and just make sure that they tick and tie right together.
Right. Well, on these, Andy, on the application...
Because you're on both.
Conditions and maintenance of certification requirements... as they apply to self-developers, each of these are distinct. Our task force, Information Blocking, has charge for three of the conditions, and the other task force has charge for the other conditions. And I can tell you, since I'm on both, for these, there really is no overlap that I can see. The place where there was the overlap between at least our two task forces was related to the definition of health information, electronic health information, or EHI, and the EHI export recommendation we made. Those had to feather. But I'm not seeing that on this particular area.
That's cool. Mine was more of a general statement just because we came across this one, but okay, that's fine.
I agree with what Denise said, that this seems to be, you know, specific to what we're talking about with information blocking. But if you do think of, you know, issues that are overlapping that we need to reach out to the other work groups about, I'm happy to help coordinate that and make sure that they are aware and the ONC staff leads are aware as well.
That's cool. Okay, guys, we're at the end of work group three, I think. Yep, we are. Has anyone got any more questions about the work of work group three, around communications and conditions of collection motions?
Sure, this is Lauren Wu again. I can circle back to the issue on the public listing of the start and end dates of a certificate. That was around the assurances condition.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a programmatic choice of ours. Nothing in the High Tech Act or our regulations requires us as ONC to post that information online. I will say that we've had the chapel website up for many years for the duration of the program and have continued to make enhancements to it and make the data as open and available as possible. And I recall the discussion we had earlier, and I apologize if I might have misconstrued or misunderstood the topic that day. When I mentioned that not all of the records are publicly available and some are really on the back end between ONC and the certification bodies for administration of the program, I was referring to the very detailed records of testing and certification. But information that we consider pretty necessary to have transparent to the providers and other end users and potential purchasers would include information such as the start and end dates of the certificate. So I might have misunderstood the discussion at the time. I think we were talking about the records retention policy, and it was just my point that not all of the records that are being proposed to be retained would include everything that's publicly available. There are a lot of records related to certification that are kind of kept for administrative reasons that are more on the back end.
But I think the reason we were concerned here is because there is a record retention period, and where the information that you retain has a retention period, and we didn't want the fact that there was a health IT product that had a start and end date and was no longer in the program, that information to go away because your retention period expired and you don't have to keep it any longer.
I understand what you're saying.
And maybe one thing I might suggest to our group is that rather than being prescriptive and suggesting in the regulatory text that ONC preserve the information on the chapel, I think we should be more, because it's the chapel today, it could be something else tomorrow. I think what we're trying to get at is we want the transparency for these specific elements of information and it to be public facing in an electronic format or an online format where it's readily available to the public. So just to my group, I suggest we might not be so prescriptive in this regulatory text in terms of referring to chapel.
Yeah, we'll go back and look at this, I think.
Okay.
We do say or in another format. We give the optionality. I made a comment. We'll come back to it. Okay? Is there anything else on work group 3? In which case, we'll move to work group 1. Okay. So,
just a comment. That was great. That was great work. And Denise, thanks for walking us through it. That was great.
Thank you.
Okay. And what group?
Andy, I just wanted to clarify for the group that, you know, unless Andy and Michael here otherwise, I think these are generally the recommendations that we're going to move forward with for work group 3 with the tweaks and changes that we've discussed today. So just wanted to be clear about that. So if anyone has any additional updates, send them to Andy and Michael.
Well, yeah, you know, I want to be respectful of, you know, the fact that people are looking at these potentially for the first time. Get feedback back to us. We've got some time before we meet again in full committee. And even when we meet in full committee, these are the final, because I'm sure that other committee members will also have feedback. But if you can get your feedback into Mike and myself, ASAP, and I would prefer it if people would say, would actually send me an affirmation to say, yep, read them, we're good with it, move on, rather than me having to assume tacit acceptance.
Hey, Andy, this is Denise.
Just
to be clear with the entire task force, there's two levels of final. There's final vote for the task force that we agree with the recommendations that are going to be advanced to the co-chairs of the HITECH, Carolyn and Robert, for deliberation and vote by the entire committee. So, and then there's that level of final when the entire committee votes on our recommendations. So what ONC is trying to get us to do is for our task force to provide final recommendations of our task force that we all agree on. So it would be helpful to hear from the rest of the task force today, very soon, or possibly before our meeting tomorrow, that whether we can vote on work group one's work group three's recommendations as a task force to advance them as our final recommendations.
Very well said.
But in the absence of any commentary coming through, we'll move to work group one. Who's on the line from work group one? Nobody?
I think we have Cheryl and Cynthia.
I thought we had Cheryl, Cynthia on the line.
I don't think we have John.
I don't know. I did. John said he would be on this call.
This is Cheryl. I'm on the line.
Hey, Cheryl. And Cynthia? Cynthia, not there? Okay.
I thought I heard her earlier.
Well, I thought I heard her, but okay, maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah.
Mike, are you there? Okay, clock. Otherwise, it might be you and me, Cheryl. Okay, let's move on. Okay, so work group one was concerned with a lot of the definitions which are new to in both the Act and the regulations, and just making clear much of the scope of what we're talking about with regard to information blocking. I'll kick off with the first one, which is around the definition of electronic health information. Now, considering we've added four words and a bit of punctuation, that is not representative of the length of time that the group has spent discussing this in many, many, many shapes or forms. The basic genesis, we are predominantly comfortable with the definition as it stands. We were sort of seeking to have some clarity around when we say electronic protected health information, which was the original drafting over here on the left from ONC. We wanted just to be clear, and I know it draws it out in the preamble, but it was to be clear in the regulation that this is as defined in HIPAA. So section 2 in this definition is additive to the HIPAA definition. The group just wanted to make that clear. And then we have this much broader definition, which is just saying, look, EHI includes any other information which could identify the individual, or there is a reasonable basis to believe that you could identify the individual, and that it's either transmitted or maintained inside electronic media. And this can relate to the past, present, or future health or condition of an individual. So if it's still focused around the individual, but has that broad temporal basis, but can also include anything around not only the provision of care, but also the past, present, or future payments, so we pluralize that, around that care. So it's a very broad definition of electronic health information that's encompassed inside this rule. Cheryl, I don't know if you want to add some comments at that point, or anybody else in the task force in looking at this definition and how and what people feel.
Yeah, Andy, I think you said it very well. In the task force, we spent quite a bit of time talking about this definition and changing it, and then changing it back to what we came up with here. I think the focus of the group was to try to provide the clarity in terms of what is included in electronic health information, but also strike the right balance so that as because at one point we'd even talked about including information that didn't identify the individual, but then it becomes the world, and how do you manage that? So I think we, you know, where we ended up is a good place.
Yeah, and I agree. I think that this, you know, obviously there are minor changes in quantity, but they really do make sense.
This is Denise. So when I think about this very, very broad definition and how it applies to the rest of the proposed rule, and you, when you think about the who's subject to the information blocking requirements, and thinking about it from a large integrated delivery healthcare perspective, which has providers and has a health plan, to the extent that they have and are using certified technology, they would be subject to providing all data, every piece of data that falls under this definition, if requested by the patient or requested for other lawful reasons, you know, if there was a request for that electronic information in electronic format. So then if you carry that over to the health IT developer, in the certification program, there's a requirement now instead of data export to do EHI export. And that would include all systems or products provided by a vendor, even those that are not certified products, if they meet the definition of a certified health IT developer. So I'm just bringing this up because that's the downstream impact of that definition. And I know the CMC task force is recommending a narrower scope than all of what's included in EHI here for the EHI data export.
That is helpful context, Denise. Thanks for that. And this is possibly an opportune moment just to have a slight a tangent discussion around the health IT developer, because and we have discussed this at length, because much as the remainder of our deliberations have been around the definition of actors, and the legislative mandate that's actually been given to in 21st Century Cures is particular around the developers of certified health IT. Not all health IT. And the work group one is coming to Task Force asking for input here, because we are struggling slightly with the evolving nature of health IT in this country since, you know, just in the last few years, since 21st Century Cures was even enacted. And there is a shift towards this, two different groups of developers, which are quite different groups as well. One that I think we're all familiar with are the app developers, developers who are both large organizations, but also very small organizations down to single person outfits that build and construct health IT apps, who are not developing certified health IT, are unlikely to ever pursue certification. However, they do maintain, transmit identifiable care information about the past, present, or future care or condition of an individual, and potentially both their provision of care and payments around that. The second class or group of second class would be pejorative, but the second group of developers are those large companies who are seeking to construct large health IT information systems, which they have no intention of ever selling. and they wish to offer them as a free good and maintain information within them around patients, both direct care and also secondary use. And they were never dreaming of getting certification because it's not in their business model to do so. And we were wondering whether there was an unintended consequence of the definition which was originally put around certified health IT developer and the constraint to certified health IT developer, which was there because of, for all good reasons, that might inadvertently be creating a business model for non-certified health IT developers. And so I'll pause there and just offer that one out to the broader task force for discussion, because it's a couple of, go on. Go ahead.
Yeah, Andy, this is Steve, and I'll say, you know, since our meeting yesterday, I had a chance to discuss this briefly with the VP of a large health IT vendor, who is represented on the task force, and the same concern was raised that this creates an uneven playing field. That there are health IT developers out there who are creating niche products that don't end up getting certified or needing to be certified, and that there is a disadvantage, or as I said, an inequity across the industry created by this differentiation based on certification status, and that doesn't really seem. I mean, I appreciate the question that does Cures give the OMC the legislative authority to determine the requirements on non-certified products? But as we were discussing in our call yesterday, our work group call, it seems that this is worth asking, and it seems like. Just intuitively, we might as well ask for or look for an even playing field for all health IT developers, regardless of whether they seek certification.
This is Denise, and I appreciate those comments that Stephen made, because if you think about it, a number of these developers who would not be subject to these regulations actually cannot be successful with their products without having access to data that is derived from certified technology. So they are oftentimes accessing and using data within their products that comes from certified technology, is collected by certified technology. So I draw a linkage between those app developers and their products to this program through that actual connection, the data connection. And I totally agree with Stephen that the way things are laid out right now, it's not a level playing field. And so there's certain developers that have huge onerous requirements placed on them and others that have none that impact the healthcare ecosystem.
And is it fair to say,
Cynthia? And one of the comments just to make is that think about how we got here. Is the government provided the certified developers via the whole system to require electronic health records through $26 billion of taxpayer money? And so a lot of where we are today is because of the federal government funding the electronic health record, health IT developer chain, which is really a few players in the oligopoly. So those outside non-certified entities that are providing and catapulting development systems didn't have the benefit of that $26 billion of taxpayer dollars. So, let's also look at the playing field from that perspective. And we are where we are.
Didn't they?
We are where we are because patients don't have access And the proposed rulemaking was because we're trying to deliver access that patients can go anywhere in the system and have access to their data on their mobile device and their physicians, and they can get the best quality of care. And at the lowest price, and God willing, they could get the actual payment information electronically like our children do through their mobile apps on banking, and we as through banking or Venmo. All of this is doable with the technology that exists today. But I just want to say we're here to deliver patients their data and their health records comprehensively. And I understand the concerns, but I also think that the whole story needs to be considered.
Yeah, Cynthia, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you earlier. This is Stephen. I guess I feel like the whole industry of health IT has been bolstered and really, you know, birthed by the incentive program. Whether or not an IT developer needs to certify or chooses to have their product certified doesn't change the fact that their products are being purchased by folks who, you know, got gazillions of dollars of money to build up their health IT infrastructure and get it up and running, and they now are the customer base. So, I guess I don't see that differentiation that, you know, the tax dollars were spent on A but not on B. I mean, you know, we are where we are today because of the tax dollar infusion, and that creates the market for products, whether they're certified or not. And again, why continue or create an unequal playing field for developers?
Any other commentary from any other members on the call?
Yeah, this is Anil. I think, you know, being at a place where we have parts of our portfolio that are certified health IT and significant parts of our portfolio that are not, I really appreciate the comments about having a level playing field. We don't want to disincentivize an organization for not having any certified products so that they can skirt the requirements among the entire portfolio. And also, we need to be sensitive to a very large organization that may have certain products that are certified, but now beholden to some of these rules in other parts of the portfolio that were never envisioned to be in the space that they might find themselves in because of another part of their business having a certified product.
Anil, just hold it, just so everyone is completely understanding what you're saying. The way the rules are drafted right now, if you have one product which is certified health IT, you are considered a developer of certified health IT and therefore in scope in the current drafting of the rules, even for those products which are not certified health IT. I think that's just what you were saying there, right, Anil?
Yes. At least that's the way that I'm not just myself, but others are understanding it too. And I'm not,
I think
I'm
that's
not
the way
saying
we're all
that
understanding
we,
it. Yep.
Yeah. And I'm not suggesting that we not have a higher burden for certified products. Clearly, that's why they're being certified. But we don't want to be in a position of creating a cottage industry of subsidiaries that don't have any certified products just so that organizations can somehow, you know, not have to have anything in their portfolio that's certified. That would seem to be not the intent of what we're trying to do here.
I think that's yet another unintended consequence.
That's right.
Any other members? No? Okay. So with this in mind, I was leaning back, thinking this through, and my screen might have gone blank to everybody. Hang on a second. Lock back in. Okay. So much of the rest of the work this group has undertaken has been focused around considering the definitions of actors. Now, as you're all aware, there are four predominant groups of actors who are referred to in 21st Century Cures, known as providers, health IT developers of certified health IT, health information exchanges, and health information networks. And the next piece of regulation that we looked at in some degree of detail was around the definition of a health information exchange and a health information network. And just to refresh everyone's memory, you can see the original text from ONC on the left. Our recommended proposing of what we were recommending could be a change to the regulation, and then the comparison markup version of it that shows you the strike-throughs and the added text.
Andy, I'm not seeing your screen any longer.
Are you not?
Is that just me, or is it everybody?
I'm seeing it.
It could just be you, Denise.
Yeah, it went blank for a second, but then it came back.
Okay, I've got it now. It came back.
You're at the end of a very dark piece of string.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. So when we were talking about through health information exchange, we went back to the drafting in 21st Century Cures, and something we realized as we went through is that actually and ONC do not need to comment on this because this is a view from the group. There are different uses of the phrase health information exchange in the actual drafting of the legislation, to our mind and our interpretation. And I think those of us that work in the industry on a day-to-day basis across organisations, we see the term health information exchange used in many, many different ways. And frankly, we see health information network also used in some slightly different ways too. But certainly health information exchange is used very differently. And in our recommendation, we're seeking to bring a little bit of clarity to that. The reason why these definitions of, quote, actors, unquote, the term actors is an ONC use. It's not actually in the legislation itself. It's because the different types of actors have different sanctioning processes against them, both in terms of fine levels, but also the process. And so it's important. And as we've been considering this through, we've been trying to think through the function that these actors perform. So a provider, that's pretty self-explanatory. A developer, that's pretty explanatory. But what's the difference in a function that a health information exchange versus a health information network performs? And we struggled with this. And we've talked about this at least as much as we talked about the definition of electronic health information. And so we've kind of come up with this proposed markup and a proposed recommendation to go to HITACH for consideration to maybe go to ONC. That's looking just to bring a bit more clarity over what these definitions mean and where you as an organisation would sit, fully recognising that some organisations will sit as both a provider and a health information network, for example. Here's drafting, and I'm sure you guys are pretty sick of my voice and have been reading this through as well. As you can see, what we're suggesting here for your consideration is kind of tying down the health information exchange term a little bit to be focused more upon the act of accessing, transmitting, processing, handling, or similar use of electronic health information, capitalized because that's now a defined term because we just defined it in the previous regulation. And then just because there are a couple of circumstances where an organization might just be doing those acts. So it could be the organization conducting that act. However, in general, HIE would be the act and the verb. Okay, and then a health information network itself would actually have this definition that we've got down, that it is conducting health information exchange.
Andy?
Yes, ma'am.
I see a problem with these changes. If I go back to the ONC's definition of health information exchange, if you go to the top there without all these strikeouts, because if you look at how they defined it, it means an individual or entity that enables access, exchange, or use of electronic health information. If I read that, the exchange would include a provider, correct, as part of that health information exchange, and so different types of providers or entities would be included in that because of that sharing.
Whereas, they would in the revised text as well, potentially, but there'd also be providers, which are another actor.
I'm just pointing out the meaning there would include a broader number of players as an exchange, whereas the health information network seems to play a different role the way the definition is written. Because the network appears to be overseeing, administering, and setting policies and agreements on the handoffs, the operational technical. So I'm reading.
Actually, it's both, Cynthia, it's both. If you look at the second definition of health information network, it's not just the policies. It's also actually doing the technology or service. And this was... We've been through this one in the work group, and we discussed that the actual proposed changes did nothing to narrow.
Yeah, it just has more strikeouts as it's been tightened in this way. I'm just pointing it out that it reads a little bit differently as to who would be included under that umbrella. Does it not?
Well, I appreciate the sentiment, and we did discuss this and actually went through it how it doesn't change the scope. It just makes it clearer, we felt. And that was the big genesis, that we were seeking to bring clarity as opposed to change the scope.
Denise, I think when you read this in total, it does. When you take the definition of EHI and the definition of HIE, you've incorporated the definition of HIE in HIN. I don't think you've lost anybody in the scope.
Absolutely not.
Andy, I just wanted to make the point from ONC's perspective to what Cynthia said, that a provider could act as a HIN or HIE, but as we describe in the preamble, they are separate definitions from what the provider definition. So I just want to be clear about that. We're looking at the function of the HIN or HIE in our definitions. So, like I said, it's possible that there could be overlap, but not the definitions are distinct and separate.
Yeah, and as we discussed at length, you are seeking to channel the absolute wording that was put into 21st Century Cures. Broader task force, there is verbose discussion underneath this section that shows you all the different usage of the term health information exchange inside 21st Century Cures, and you can see the different usages. This is an opportune moment to correct this without changing the scope and without alleviating any of the intent.
Okay, I can't see the bottom, the second point under Health Information Network, but where is, as ONC defined, Health Information Exchange included in the Health Information Network?
Yeah, it's clearly, it says Health Information Exchange and Health Information Exchange just there.
As ONC had determined the individual and the entity role up above, where is that included in the HIN definition?
Okay.
So what you're saying is no one is held account. I think the challenge for ONC is Congress gave four buckets of accountability, but there's no player accountable if you define the health information exchange as just an act, right?
Well, we have actually said just
that players are accountable by...
Cynthia, as we said, and as it says here, or the organization or entity conducting that act. Because we wanted to make it clear in the regulation versus the concept of a particular class of individuals or entities or limited set of purposes. We wanted to make this rather than focus the definition upon the what you're doing versus your intent. Because limited set of purpose, well, what's the purpose? Let's just make it accessing, transmitting, processing, handling. Much clearer, much more succinct, and has that level of inclusiveness that you're looking for.
And it still does include or the organization or entity conducting that act.
Yeah.
So I don't think we lost anything in the definition. We've tightened it up is what we've done.
Right. It's still broad enough.
The work group. Yeah.
It's still broad enough to capture everyone that needs to be captured. I don't think we lose anything with this. I think that it covers what we need to cover and still allows for two separate definitions.
And frankly, if you go and read the way...
Why then primarily between among a particular class of individuals or entity? Why, or for even a limited set of purposes, why did you pick those?
Well, as we discussed, we all had difficulties with the term primarily, because then, okay, what's the exclusion criteria for that? Particular, because what's the exclusion criteria for that? And limited, what's the exclusion criteria for that? If anything, in our definition, we just said, no, it's not about whether it's primarily, it's if you're exchanging information. It's not about whether it's a particular group of individuals, it's if you're exchanging information. And it's not a limited set of purposes, it's if you're accessing, transmitting, processing, or handling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the act. It actually makes it, we think, or we felt in the group, much more precise. And actually, precisely is the wrong word, clear.
Right. It cleared up the definition. It took away words that are very vague.
Yeah, I would say ONC's proposed definition here has lots of vagueness and room for varying interpretation.
Aren't there entities today that consider themselves health information exchanges in the use of the word?
I'm sorry?
In today's world, are there not organizations that actually consider themselves health information exchanges?
In terms of a proper noun, there is, some organizations say, yeah, we are a health information exchange. They are more in the definition of a health information network, and this was John. I'm going to sort of try and paraphrase John and put words in his mouth, but that was kind of one of his sentiments he articulated, was that, you know, fundamentally the Indiana Health Information Exchange is a health information network, but that he didn't have an issue with that.
Right.
Are also
Andy?
Products. Oh, go on, Cheryl.
Oh, no, this is Denise. I was just going to say, I can give it another example in Wisconsin, because I was part of creating the legislation. So we have the Wisconsin Health Information Network, WISHN, Statewide Health Information Network. That's what their name is, WISHN. And we used HIE and HIN interchangeably. When you talk to WISHN, they provide services for health information exchange to facilitate that. But they call themselves an HIE.
Yeah,
but they also say, oh, well, we're an HIE, noun. We're an HIN in our name, noun. And we conduct HIE, verb. So I really like what you're proposing here, because it really does clarify a word that's used in various fashions. So, I mean, I know in Wisconsin, they serve as a network, a statewide network, and they conduct HIE functions.
Thanks, Denise. That's helpful context. And at the end of the day, there are vendors out there who sell health information exchange products. So, yeah, it's used in many, many different ways. And if I quickly scroll down, in 21st Century Cures, there are different uses of the term, both uppercase and lowercase. And actually, we found three different sort of contexts around how it was used, and you can read that at your leisure. So it's useful feedback from the border group.
Andy, can I ask you a question or a point of clarification? I know we need to get to public comments in a minute, but are you all intending to differentiate between the noun and the verb by capitalizing the noun and not capitalizing the verb? Or what? I'm just trying to figure it out because right now, you know, in Cures, Congress specifically said access, exchange, or use of electronic health information would constitute information blocking if you interfere with the access, exchange, or use. And we define those terms. So just for clarity, I'm trying to understand if there would be a distinction made in what you're doing between the noun and the verb.
I personally hadn't considered that. I'm not sure if anybody else in the group was thinking like that. I was much more, if it's capitalized, it's a defined term. If it's not capitalized, it's not. And given that we have a definition of health information, electronic health information, that's why, and then of health information exchange, that would be why that was capitalized in the health information network definition. If you're telling us that actually, if you and Mr. Lipinski come back and tell us that actually, no, you don't want to do it like that, then that's fine too. Just tell us.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've also been in the habit of capitalizing defined terms, but I really like the idea here of saying the term is defined. When in the definition, we should clarify that the term can be used as a noun or a verb, and then perhaps capitalize it when we're using it as, quote, a proper noun, and then lowercase it when we're using it as a verb. It seems weird to have a capital verb. But I think that if we go back to the definitions and we just say this is the term, you know, as it's being used, it can be used as a noun or a verb, and then go on from there.
Yeah, I must say part of me would almost like to not have or the organisation or entity conducting that act, so the HIE is the act, HIN is the organisation. But I fully take on board that the way that Cures is drafted, it has HIE as a noun as well as a verb. And also, you know, to Cynthia's well-made point, we want to make sure we don't inadvertently lose somebody by tightening up this bit too much. So that's why we've got that in there.
Well, and there's other words in the dictionary that can be both a noun and a verb, and it describes it in the definition. So I think we've done that. Your work group has proposed that HIE is a verb, an action, or it's the organization doing that action, a noun. I think we've captured both the noun and the verb and the noun in that definition. And then when you use it down in the HIN definition, you're going to refer back to the HIE definition to see what that means.
Hey, Andy, yep. I don't mean to cut the session. We need to go to public comment.
Oh, we do. Okay. Operator, can we do the public comment, please?
Yes, thank you. If you'd like to make a public comment, please press *1 on your telephone keypad, and a confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press *2 if you'd like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys.
Thank you very much. We'll just pause for a couple of moments. I'll just carry on until we see if any comments queued up. So that's the drafting in there. There was actually another key sort of like delta that we did in here is around the use of the term unaffiliated and affiliated. So if you look at the original ONC drafting, there was a term around it, unaffiliated. And there's a good
level of description inside the preamble on their intent there, and it all makes sense. But then, you know, as we were considering this through, and one process of drafts, instead of having two either ors on the definition of HIM, we had four to count for affiliated and unaffiliated. And then, you know, yesterday we just removed the term unaffiliated completely, because we don't believe that in the definition of the health information network, we should be talking about only unaffiliated individuals and entities, because, you know, it can also include affiliated individuals and entities. And we, so we shouldn't really have that distinction in there. And that was another key delta. Okay, have we got any comments on public lines?
No comments at this time.
Okay, thanks. So unaffiliated versus affiliated, has anyone got any sentiment on that, like, nuance that's in there?
I got the sense that ONC was trying to capture the idea that there may be, like, for instance, a health system that has several entities connected up, but they own or control those entities in some legal fashion. So they would be considered affiliated. And I got the sense that they were trying to not apply some of this to the internal operations of the health system when it came to their interoperability within their own legal framework.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, from our perspective, like Andy has said, and I don't want to sound like a broken record, but in Cures, there's these four distinct actors, right? Developers, providers, networks, and exchanges. And the way I'm reading it, you know, we tried to make definitions that made clear the distinction, and we tried our best, and of course you have recommendations, the distinction between those four actors. And that making that distinction is really important, particularly because, as Andy mentioned, Congress described that there would be a different knowledge component for providers versus developers, networks, and exchanges, and also different penalty structure for developers, networks, and exchanges versus providers. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the interpretation of our proposed definition for HIN, but my read is that if you take out unaffiliated, the definition could potentially swallow all actors, including providers. If you read it, it would probably, I think most providers could fall into that definition potentially.
So we can have a long conversation about that. That I don't think that's true, because many providers don't determine, oversee, or administer, or provide, manage, or control health information exchange. They participate in it, but they don't fall into the HIN definition. But there are, as Cynthia pointed out, there are some providers who do. You know, we have large provider groups that cover many, many geographically dispersed sites that do participate in health information exchange, and therefore would fall under the definition of the health information network. And I believe a sentiment coming out from the work group, which is a microcosm of the sentiment, which I think we've heard for the last, since HITACH was created, was that we want to promote information sharing across all those entities, between all those entities, and we want to address information blocking, which does occur inside those organizations right now. I can give you a list of a dozen large multi-site provider organizations who do not exchange information between their sites, which would be beneficial for a patient if they were to so do. So I this is now a personal comment, not as your chair. I personally do not have an issue with a provider being also an HIN. And I don't think we should, that my position would be, I don't think we should. Obviously, we have to build a consensus, but I don't struggle with that.
Well, and I think by that notion that a lot of large providers are HINs.
you know, and do have trouble sharing data even within the bounds of their organization.
Yep. So someone else might say something there as well.
Yeah, Cynthia, I was agreeing with both of those points where the point is to get access to the information, and that a provider that needs to share that information for that patient to get the best of care, if they're acting at and exchanging that data and they're acting as an HIN or they're acting in the exchange, then they would fall under that definition to have equitable type of penalty under that definition.
Right, and
so
I think it was,
you may be able to be
sorry.
A provider, but even if you're a provider and you're acting as an HIE or HIN, one would argue, well, why wouldn't you be penalized equitably to any other HIE or HIN for not for information blocking to the patients?
Right, and just a quick point, I think it was to Stephen's point, you know, the way our goal was, I mean, as when we talk about in preamble, is that these HIN specifically is a functional definition. So, like I said before, the way I'm reading it is that, you know, and what we say in preamble is that providers could potentially be a HIN based on their function. I guess the point that I was trying to make is that we were cautious, and I just would say that you all in making your recommendations should do the same, that it Congress made these four buckets of actors, and you don't want to have a definition that would always swallow the other actors in another group. And that's what we were cautious of.
Mark, we recognize that. We recognize the boundaries you're working through. But we also recognize, similar to the conversation that we had earlier about health IT developers, that the health IT ecosystem is a fast-moving beast and changing substantially. And it is behoven upon this group and HITACH going forward that we're supposed to bring those changes to Congress's attention so that they can react accordingly. So I personally, if we all agree, I don't have a problem representing that.
Also, just to that notion of swallowing entirely, I mean, you know, a solo chiropractor or optometrist's office is very different than a large, you know, organization with a health IT shop that's developing, you know, internal APIs to share data across their network, you know, and I don't think saying that some providers, you know, are health information networks means that all providers are.
Oh, that's absolutely true. I think it was more the HIE, HIN distinction. Although by your definition there, the single man podiatrist is a provider. The 1,500 physician hospital group is a provider. You know, they are by default the same thing in terms of how this would address them. So you can't have it both ways.
But wait, isn't the 1,000 group that's sharing also an HIE or HIN?
It may be if it creates the infrastructure.
Not. But maybe not.
But wait a minute, that goes back.
Right, it depends.
The verb, or that, you know, if you're saying exchange, you don't need to say, okay, I am by default a capital letter HIE. I am actually providing exchange, and therefore I should be in the bucket of an exchange or an HIN.
But Cynthia, they may be using their native capabilities of their EHR to share information, but yet they have not created a network infrastructure and policies and control and governance around exchange between all of their entities within their health system, that they are all on the same integrated platform, and that's how they exchange within and without, outside. So, you know, I get it that provider could encompass an entire health system with 1,200 providers. You almost have to look at that as it's the corporate structure that's providing the infrastructure for those 1,200 providers to conduct their business. And they would be an HIN in that case if they've created all of these health information exchange capabilities that are just not native to their product that they're using.
Well, let's scale it down a bit.
ONC to weigh in on this, because as I first read their original definition of HIE, that provider would be, under the way it's written now, before we made all these changes were made, that provider would be accountable as an HIE also.
Cynthia, they are. We're not discussing that point. But the point we're discussing right now is that...
That's not accurate. I just want to clarify. By our definition, a provider, based on the function they're providing, based on their function, could be an HIN or an HIE, but a read of our definition, I don't think, says that all providers acting as a provider would net constitute an exchange or network. You have to look at our definition. So I just want to be very clear about that. And just, Andy, I'll let you go. I know we're over. I just want to say, all I'm saying is to look at the implications of removing unaffiliated in your recommendations and see if you all want to move forward with that.
Yeah, that's a good point, and that is something we are doing. We're meeting again as work group one later today, predominantly on price transparency, to also touch upon this. I think, Cynthia, the point we were trying to discuss there was that where you've got a very small provider that might only be like a single person shop, and you've got someone who's a bit larger, that is maybe just a single hospital site, they fall under the same definition of provider right now. But because they're not involved in setting up infrastructure to exchange information, they wouldn't fall under either the HIE or HIN definition in either the original ONC drafting or our redraft. And that is something we need to be aware of. And if we need to address that, then I'd welcome your input on that.
Thanks, Andy.
Okay, no worries. Okay, guys, thank you very, very much for bearing with us for 2 hours this morning. We're going to meet again and again, and I think maybe again. And we've also, coming out after the next HITAC meeting, we have an early morning session the morning after to meet again as a task force. And I'll be looking to bring in the input we should have received from the board of HITAC there and then. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.